Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was co-hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group and the George Mason University Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property. It was recorded on Monday, April 1st, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording today's call for a possible use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome back as our moderator, Professor Mark Schultz. Mark Schultz is a professor at Southern Illinois University Law School. He's also a member of the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Rights Practice Group leadership team and a co-founder of our co-sponsor for today's teleforum, the George Mason University School of Law's Center for Protection of Intellectual Property. We're always happy to have them as a co-sponsor. And with that, Professor Schultz, please go right ahead with your introductory remarks.
Thank you, Dean. Today we'll be discussing, our program is entitled Copyright and Commercialization after Kurtzang v. John Wiley and Sons. Joining us will be Professor Christine Osenga, Alan Adler, General Counsel and Vice President of Government Affairs for the Association of American Publishers, Professor Christopher Newman from George Mason University School of Law, and Ben Scheffner, Vice President of Legal Affairs for the Motion Picture Association of America. I will give a brief introduction of each of the speakers right before the remarks. Let me first proceed to give a background of the case we'll be discussing, which is Kurtzang. Kurtzang is particularly significant with respect to international markets for American publishers, movie producers, and other producers of copyrighted content. Traditionally, those producers have chosen to segment their markets abroad, choosing the right price and the right time at which to sell their goods abroad, right for them. They in part relied on an importation right under the Copyright Act, that has been whittled away in recent decisions and now has been virtually eliminated by Kurtzang, an importation right that allowed them to prevent the unauthorized importation of products of books and movies and other versions of their work that they had authorized for publication abroad. Of course, they are still protected from the importation of pirated goods from abroad, but what happened in Kurtzang is the following. A graduate student from Thailand named Supap Kurtzang, who was attending Cornell, realized he was able to buy a very inexpensive international student editions of textbooks back home in Thailand. He saw an arbitrage opportunity, and he started importing these goods and selling them on eBay and other auction sites, I believe. He made nearly $1 million doing so. As we all know, American versions of textbooks can be quite expensive. They're far beyond the reach of students in the international market, so these international student versions, which are typically in paperback, are much less expensive, but contain all of the same content, just not in the same hardback format. In any event, though, they're substantively the same book, and they exist in order to reach that particular market. Mr. Kurtzang was sued by John Wiley and Sons. And Mr. Kurtzang defended himself, arguing that the rights of the publishers had been extinguished after the first authorized sale of their goods, of the books. Copyright law's first sale doctrine is a very important doctrine in copyright law with long provenance that says that after the first sale of a copyrighted work in physical form, that physical copy then can be resold. It's no longer under control of the copyright owner. And indeed, for many years, that doctrine has allowed the existence of a used bookstore market, of a secondary market in used books in colleges and the like. But that right had not been applied to products produced abroad. In this case, what the Supreme Court essentially said is that the first sale doctrine trumps the importation right. I'll let my fellow panelists give you the technical details as necessary to their discussion. I'm painting with a broad brush. So with that, I'm about to turn it over to our panelists so that they can address this in greater detail. First thing leaves many questions open about future commercialization. What's next? Whether there will be an attempt to restore an importation right? If the copyright owners cannot restore an importation right, what does this mean for foreign markets for their works? What does this mean for the U.S. market? And what does this mean for commercialization generally? So now I will first turn this over to Professor Kristin Osenga. Each panelist will speak for about 8 minutes, and then we will then have a discussion among the panelists, and then we'll open up to our audience for questions and answers. At that time, Dean Reuter will explain to you how you can get in the question queue. Until then, your microphone will be muted. Okay. Allow me to introduce Kristin Osenga. Kristin Osenga is a professor of law at the University of Richmond School of Law. She practiced IP law for several years before joining Richmond, and before that, she clerked for Judge Richard Lynn of the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. She's also been a visiting professor at Emory University School of Law and at William and Mary School of Law. Professor Osenga also did our Kurtzsang podcast for the Federalist Society prior to the Supreme Court argument and then afterwards summarizing the decision. So with that, I'm happy to turn it over to Kristin. Professor Osenga, please proceed.
Thank you, Mark. Mark has hit the highlights of this case, but there are a few things that I'd like to reiterate or mention. First of all, this is an interesting case, because international exhaustion of intellectual property rights has been percolating around for a while. The issue of international copyright exhaustion was taken up in 2010 in the Costco versus Omega case. In that case, Justice Kagan recused herself because of her time at the Solicitor General's office, and the opinion resulted in a 4-4 tie. It took a couple of years, but the issue came back up in a case that I think was the right case for the justices to take, the Kurtzsang case. It involved a very straightforward set of facts, as Mark laid out, and a petitioner defendant, Mr. Kurtzsang, who was neither too sympathetic nor too villainous. Although the case purported to be a straight statutory interpretation case involving the first sale doctrine under Section 109A of the Copyright Act and a copyright holder's rights under Section 602A, the case really ended up turning much more on policy, which is why the status of the petitioner defendant is important to me. Second, it is important to note, as Mark noted, that the opinion does not eviscerate copyright holders' protections altogether. The first sale doctrine of Section 109A allows the owner of a particular copy that embodies a copyrighted work that was lawfully made under this title to resell that particular copy of the work, the resale right. While the appellate court had determined this phrase to implicitly require that the particular copy was lawfully made in the United States, the Supreme Court simply held that the first sale doctrine applies to copyrighted works, whether made here or abroad. Notice the requirement, though, is that it's lawfully made. This means that a copyright holder in the United States is still permitted to sue for infringement based on importation and sale of pirated works or otherwise unlawfully made copies of copyrighted works. Third, the dissent in this case focuses nearly exclusively on statutory interpretive methods. As a rule, this is generally the method of statutory interpretation I prefer. But as Justice Kagan said during oral argument, I find the language, meaning the language of the Copyright Act, a bit perplexing, and I can kind of see it both ways. I don't fully endorse Justice Kagan's statement that the language is a bit perplexing, but it is clear to me that there are two sides to this story, and both of them have merit. And as I'll mention below, there's actually a third side to the story that I prefer. Justice Alito recognized the two-sided story at oral argument, asking Deputy Solicitor General Malcolm Stewart which side was worse, side one being the parade of horribles that would arise if copyright holders could prevent importation and resale of copies of copyrighted goods made abroad, or whether it'd be worse if the market segmentation and price discrimination ability would be frustrated if the first sale doctrine applied to goods made lawfully abroad. Mr. Stewart, after failing to persuasively argue for middle ground, ended up admitting that the parade of horribles, if importation could be prevented, would be much worse. So this leads me to my reaction to the case. To be honest, I did not have a really strong reaction one way or another, in part because I believe both sides to the story have merit, and then there's a third side that hasn't been told yet. On one hand, I am generally in favor of strong property and intellectual property rights, although my bias is towards strong patent rights, and I'm slightly less concerned about copyrights, but I do see the benefit of being able to segment the market and price discriminate. These are rights that intellectual property generally provides. In some cases, the market can be segmented through technological means, but obviously with things like textbooks, that is not really an option. With ebooks and other software-driven copyrighted works, there already exist licensing schemes that allow for copyright holders to retain greater control over their copyrighted goods. I imagine these schemes will be expanded to fill in the gaps that the Kurtzsang opinion has left. I'm sure that some of the later panelists will be better able to speak to this. On the other hand, while the parade of horribles discussion that ran through the oral argument and opinion has some traction, I think there is another side of the story that is more attractive to me. But first, with respect to the parade of horribles, the hypotheticals posed about a tourist on a trip abroad buying books to give to friends and family, or selling them to a used bookstore and then being found liable for infringement, or another story about a museum having the inability to display a work of art purchased abroad without obtaining permission from the copyright holder, or the story from the opinion about libraries being unable to circulate or distribute books that were published or printed abroad without contacting each and every copyright holder for each and every book, some 200 million, these certainly sound dire. But the story I'd rather hear, however, is how the opinion affects avenues of international trade. The world is a global marketplace, and intellectual property law that pretends as though the borders of countries act as fences that keep copyrighted goods in or out is simply not realistic. As Justice Kagan noted in concurrence, there are pitfalls associated with the inability to price discriminate, but that should be addressed by Congress, and I agree. And I would add, it should be addressed by Congress as part of a big picture look at how international trade and the free market work and how best to protect intellectual property rights. And so instead of calling this a story about the parade of horribles versus price discrimination, let's instead call it a story about how we need to take a fresh look at how we can better protect United States intellectual property in the increasingly global marketplace. Back to you, Mark.
Thank you, Kristen. Next, we will hear from Alan Adler, the General Counsel and Vice President of Government Affairs for the Association of American Publishers. Mr. Adler is a native of New York. He received his BA in history from Binghamton University, New York, and a JD from the George Washington University School of Law. For the past two decades, Mr. Adler has led advocacy with respect to all major Association of American Publisher policy decisions related to copyright protection, freedom of expression, digital issues, piracy, privacy rights, product safety, and public access to scholarly publications. We're quite pleased to have him here because of his association's direct interest in this case, as well as his great knowledge of the subject. Thank you, Mr. Adler. I turn it over to you.
Thank you, Mark. Let me see if I can briefly tell you what we thought in the publishing community this case was about as we went into it, and then I can give you some of the ideas about why we were so concerned and somewhat troubled by the decision reached by the Supreme Court. We saw this case really as one about affirming specific protections that Congress had built into the Copyright Act, largely at the request of the book publishing industry, in fact, to protect the traditional abilities of authors and publishers and other copyright owners to control the timing, the content, the packaging, pricing, and quality of the works that they release into the market, whether that market is one at home in the United States or abroad. The protections necessarily include the exclusive right to control distribution of legitimate works as well as pirated works. And in 1976, after a fairly long time of consideration of the issue through hearings and studies, Congress amended the Copyright Act to clarify the scope of the distribution right while limiting the application of the first sale doctrine ability to limit the scope of the distribution right. And what it did specifically was to create sections dealing with the right of a copyright owner to prohibit unauthorized importation, subject only to certain specific exceptions with respect to governmental, scholarly, educational, and personal use of legitimate copies of previously sold works purchased abroad. Congress intended that the U.S. publishers and other copyright owners would be able to develop international as well as domestic markets for their works, and recognize that the prices as well as the nature of the editions made available in those foreign markets might vary as necessary in order to be able to establish particular foreign markets. A contrary ruling by the court, we all believed, would mean that the ability of copyright owners to establish foreign markets would effectively come at the price of direct competition with the copyright owner's own domestic markets, severely impairing their incentives to create and disseminate copyrightable works for the public good, as well as to support authors and other creators of copyrighted works in their endeavors. So when we looked at the majority decision by the Supreme Court, at least from my perspective, there were at least three major points that were very troubling. One was the majority's linguistic analysis. We all recognized going into the case that it was less than satisfactory that the court's mission was going to be really the narrow statutory construction of five words, as Kristen had mentioned, the phrase lawfully made under this title, to determine whether or not that phrase restricts the scope of the first sale doctrine geographically, a very narrow task of construction that really did not give the court the ability to take into account some of the broader policies underlying the Copyright Act, and particularly the provisions dealing with unauthorized importation. So when you look at the majority's linguistic analysis, the majority was very concerned to make sure that in construing the language of these provisions of the Copyright Act, that it was not going to render statutory text in the importation provisions pointless or superfluous. Unfortunately, it ended up doing just that with respect to specific exceptions that Congress had provided in those provisions in order to ensure that copies obtained through individuals' personal travel for private use, as well as copies obtained for library lending or archival purposes by an organization operated for scholarly, educational, or religious purposes, would not be affected by the prohibition on unauthorized importation. Secondly, when the majority did its analysis of the parade of horribles, it uncritically concluded that the practical problems that had been described by the petitioner and his supporters were too serious, too extensive, and too likely to come about to dismiss them as insignificant. But this conclusion was reached even though all of those horribles were entirely hypothetical in the sense that they have never actually occurred. And surely it should have been understood that had they occurred, or were they to occur in the future following a decision by the Supreme Court, their occurrence clearly could be subsequently addressed by Congress. But the court didn't really take that into consideration. But most disturbing was perhaps the court's majority analysis of the history of the first sale doctrine with respect to the market segmentation claims that were made by the copyright owners. The court, in tracing the history of the first sale doctrine back to English common law, emphasized the fact that when it was considering that doctrine and then looking at the nature of the parade of horribles that had been discussed, one of the things that was important was to consider them in the light of the ever-growing importance of foreign trade to America. But the court, in considering the importance of foreign trade to America, seemed to only consider its importance in terms of the interests of consumers and retailers, and not very much in terms of the interests of the producers and manufacturers of the goods that constitute, of course, the commodities of that foreign trade. And then when the majority ultimately went on to concede that its decision would make it difficult and perhaps impossible for publishers to divide foreign and domestic markets, it said that it could find no principle of copyright law suggesting that publishers were especially entitled to such rights. And it went on to say that the Constitution's language nowhere suggests that its limited exclusive rights should include a right to divide markets or a concomitant right to charge different purchasers different prices for the same book. But of course, nowhere in the Constitution does it forbid copyright owners from engaging in such conduct. And Congress, in the 1976 Reform of Copyright Act, clearly intended that just such capabilities would be available to copyright owners. And let me make two points with respect to that. One of the most important changes that the 1976 Reform of the Copyright Act made from the previous 1909 Act was to go from a principle of the indivisibility of copyright rights, which meant that a copyright owner could dispose of its copyright rights, but had to dispose of them all as a bundle and could not separate and distinguish the various rights that comprise that bundle in its transactions. In 1976, the Congress said just the opposite. It said that henceforth, copyright owners would be able to have recognized the fact that they acquire multiple interests with respect to their individual works, and that any of the rights specified in Section 106 of the Copyright Act could be licensed or sublicensed, could be granted with limitations on time, geography, or the type of use that would be involved. The exercise of territorial rights in this sense was hardly a new or controversial subject, and yet the majority in the Kurtzang decision seemed to have ignored that important history of the Act. Finally, of course, the result of the majority decision in Kurtzang was to move the United States copyright law from embodying a doctrine of national exhaustion of rights, as represented by the first sale doctrine, to one that would now constitute an unprecedented regime for U.S. law of international exhaustion. And in doing so, the court seemed to give very little thought to how that would impact, ultimately, foreign trade in global markets as we continue to move forward with the growth of such trade in the future. So those are the concerns that we hope to see addressed when Congress, which was really the appropriate body to consider these issues, reevaluates not only the changes that it had made in 1976, but how those changes were construed by the Supreme Court in the Kurtzang case. Mark?
Thank you, Alan. Next, I will bring it to Christopher Newman. Christopher Newman is an assistant professor of law at George Mason University School of Law. Prior to joining George Mason, he served as an Olin Searle Fellow at the UCLA School of Law. Prior to that, for over 7 years, he was a litigation associate with Irell and Manella in Los Angeles, where he represented clients in disputes involving contracts, business, torts, and IP. And before that, he clerked for Judge Alex Kaczynski of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, with whom he co-authored an important article on fair use. His current research agenda concerns copyright and property theory, and he's particularly interested in licensing and commercialization, which makes him an appropriate person to join us today. Christopher, I'm happy to hand it over to you.
Thanks a lot, Mark. This case is actually, as you just mentioned, very interesting to me because this is a line of doctrine which has already begun, and I think in future even more, is going to start pressing courts to articulate a clear understanding of the difference between property transactions and contractual transactions. What I want to do in my time here is to try to parse a little bit where we're left. What's the law on the ground? Obviously, there's, you know, it may be desirable for Congress to revisit some of these issues, but until they do, we're left with trying to figure out what the implications of this opinion are and where it leaves copyright owners. To what extent are they still able to use copyright law in the aid of segmenting markets internationally? To what extent are they not? And what would be the cost of doing so under the regime as it's now been left for us? And the first thing I want to note is that, you know, even though, as Kristen and Alan pointed out, this is one of the most textualist, you know, in a certain sense, on both sides, opinions we've seen in a while, and that it's all about these five words and all of these sorts of various forms of statutory interpretation are being brought to bear to figure out their meaning. But to me, the really interesting thing about this case is that, in fact, neither faction on the court actually seems to believe that first sale doctrine is strictly defined by the words of the statute. Now, here's what I mean by that. I mean, we know, for example, Justice Ginsburg, you know, her preferred solution would have been to, you know, protect the importation right by holding that, you know, only goods manufactured in the U.S. Are subject to first sale, or at least are subject to that full exhaustion. But then she would have said, however, if a, you know, if a copy manufactured abroad gets imported into the United States and sold in the United States with authorization, that would exhaust the importation right. That would make first sale doctrine attach, and therefore that would avoid all of the parade of horribles, in her view. As long as you had one authorized sale in the U.S., that would cut off the parade of horribles. And she argued that by saying, well, really, first sale is governed by the underlying common law Bobbs Merrill doctrine. And in order to take that position, that was part of the reason, I think, why she failed to carry the day, because she, in effect, had to argue that in future we can fix this by adopting a holding that sort of limits the actual literal meaning of the statute, or at least a doctrine that is not grounded in the literal meaning of the statute. Now, what's interesting to me is that Breyer does the same thing. There's a part in the opinion where Breyer says he's trying to avoid the claim that he has essentially eviscerated the importation doctrine. And he says, look, there's four situations in which it will still have bite. Two of them involve the idea that you've got a foreign publisher or a foreign printer who prints copies of a book, and prior to any authorized sale overseas, sends them to the United States. Now, the only way that Breyer can claim that that, even under his holding, that that would somehow still be a violation of the importation right is because he's not following the statute literally either. The statute says that anyone who is a lawful owner of a copy is entitled to dispose of it as they please. Presumably someone who manufactures, who is licensed to lawfully print copies of a book abroad, if they have a license to do that, to print the copy of the book, then presumably once they've printed it, they are the lawful owner of it. In which case, if you're literal about the statute, that would mean they can sell it directly into the United States if they want without any authorization. So neither side is taking that literal view. Both of them seem to think that you still need an authorized first sale, i.e. authorized by the copyright owner, before this exhaustion will attach, which sounds like, to some extent, they're really still reading the statute as of a piece with exhaustion doctrine generally. Exhaustion doctrine, for example, under patent law, as they construed it recently under the Quanta case. And that does leave at least a little bit of wiggle room for copyright owners, because it sounds like it should be at least possible, for example, for a U.S. publisher to enter into particular kinds of licenses that limit the discretion of their publishers to sell abroad, and that to the extent that publishers fail to abide by those restrictions, there would still be an importation right violation. The difficulty is that publishers in order to actually have a business model abroad, if they actually want to distribute their books abroad, they're going to have to run into the question of, can I, as a viable business model, distribute copies to my customers abroad without rendering those customers the owners of the copies? And there might be some room to do that. It's going to be obviously less, very much less convenient and more expensive. But, you know, we've seen the parameters of this doctrine in two different cases in the Ninth Circuit. There's, on the one hand, you have the Verner v. Autodesk, and on the other hand, you have UMG Recordings v. Augusto. And what you get from those two cases is that there is some ability of copyright owners to characterize a particular distribution as a license rather than as a sale that transfers ownership. However, in order to characterize it as a license, you're probably going to have to enter into some form of transaction, i.e. an agreement with the purchaser, or I should say, you know, purchaser is already a, you know, to some extent begging the question here, but the user who acquires lawful possession of the copy, there's going to have to be some sort of agreement, and there's going to have to be some sort of limitation on the extent of the use and the possession rights that the user is given. Now, that might make it possible for publishers like John Wiley, who for some reason want to, for example, for, you know, educational purposes, want to make copies of books available overseas at a cheaper rate without necessarily allowing for arbitrage to have them imported back into the U.S. It means, though, that they would have to, you know, create a relatively cumbersome form of distribution network in which they purport to lease or license these copies. And they would at least have to make some effort at telling the lessees or the licensees who are acquiring use of the copies that after a certain period of time they have to destroy them or return them. They would have to make some effort to create an actual form of ongoing control. And if they did that, they would be able to retain, arguably, control and ownership of the copies. Of course, one of the wrinkling factors here is that there's a huge sort of absolutely unaddressed question in this whole line of doctrine, which is which law governs whether you are an owner of a copy? And of course, that's the key question on which all the first sale doctrine turns. When do you become an owner of a copy? And it's left, you know, you would think that as a baseline matter within the U.S., that would be a matter of state law because we're talking about property ownership of a chattel. And yet, if you read, you know, Verner and Augusto, it seems like the federal courts have been sort of implicitly deciding this as though it were a matter of federal law without spending too much time thinking about whether it is or not. When you add the international context in, it becomes trickier then because the question whether someone is an owner of a copy, we'd have to ask, well, would that be decided by the law of Thailand when you're trying to license copies of your book over there? Or is it going to be a matter of federal doctrine that they're going to create some standards as to when someone becomes a licensee or an owner? So I think that's where the action is going to be for the next phase of trying to understand how this copyright law functions. And I wouldn't be surprised if within a few years we see cases like that, you know, coming up through the courts and some of these questions getting decided. So with that, I will stop and send it back to you, Mark.
Thank you, Christopher. Next, joining us will be Ben Schaffner. Mr. Schaffner is Vice President of Legal Affairs for the Motion Picture Association of America. He's held a number of positions in the entertainment industry prior to joining the MPAA, including Senior Counsel at NBC Universal, as well as other positions at NBC Universal. He also worked at Fox Entertainment. He is a graduate of Berkeley's Law School. He's also a graduate of Harvard. And before attending law school, he was a political reporter, including for the Capitol Hill newspaper Roll Call. He's also gained a bit of fame prior to joining the MPAA as the author of the Campaign to Copyrights blog, a well-regarded blog on copyright law. We're pleased to have Mr. Schaffner joining us, of course, to hear the broader perspective of from other parts of the creative industries about the implications of Kurtzsang. Ben, I'm happy to turn it over to you now.
Thank you, Mark, and I'm honored to be a part of this discussion. My previous panelists have done a very good job laying out the law and exactly what the Supreme Court held and sort of how it got there. I thought what I would do is talk a little bit more about this case from a business perspective on exactly how it will affect the business practices of companies in the entertainment industry, and specifically the motion picture industry, which I represent. I should say that the MPAA did file an amicus brief in support of John Wiley and Sons, along with the RIAA, which is the Trade Association for the Record Labels, but I should make clear that I'm speaking here on my own, especially with respect to the particular business practices of our companies. So just to sort of set the stage here, and I just, most of this is probably not completely new to most of the listeners, but I just wanted to sketch out a little bit sort of how the motion picture industry distributes movies. As everybody knows, it's not just a one-size-fits-all and all-at-once proposition. Each individual studio separately licenses distribution in various territories around the world, and they also separately license different kinds of rights. And what do I mean by that? There is first the, you're probably familiar with the term windows. Basically, what a window is a particular form of distribution for a particular time. So typically what happens is the movie studio will first license for theatrical distribution, meaning publicly perform a movie in a movie theater. Then there might be some limited distribution in things like hotels and on airplanes. Then it's distributed on DVDs, what we call hard goods, in various territories. And then you have all sorts of other forms of distribution, for example, on HBO and other pay outlets, and then eventually on free broadcast TV. As Alan alluded to before, this is a relatively new but very distinct feature of distribution, where copyright owners can divvy up the markets by territory. And also by time. And what Section 602 of the Copyright Act did back in 1976 is really sort of enable this these forms of distribution on a territory by territory basis by making it a violation of the distribution right to import into the U.S. Copies that were at least made abroad. So why do movie studios and others engage in such practices? One, it has to do with timing. Various territories, it may make sense to release a movie in various forms at different times. Two, there's different marketing strategies. Obviously, you want to market a movie differently in the U.S. than in England, than in China. Three, there are cultural differences that you may want to take into account when you are releasing. You know, some different territories have different attitudes about things like sex and violence and religion, and companies don't want their sort of the wrong edition to be released in the wrong place. And then also very importantly from our perspective is combating piracy. And let me tell you what I mean by that. Obviously, piracy is different in all territories and because of different market conditions and the ability of people to pay for legitimate goods. So, you know, selling a brand new DVD at $20 in the U.S. may not make sense in a place like China. And if people in the U.S. may think, well, you know what, $20, it may be a little bit more than I want to pay, but it's pretty reasonable and certainly less of a hassle than pirating. However, if DVDs were sold at $20 in a retail store in China, the vast majority of people wouldn't be able to afford that, and they may be driven instead to piracy. So what various of our of the major motion picture studios have done is done at least experiments, and they've sort of blossomed into real marketing practices of charging very low prices for new DVDs in places like China. So instead of selling it for $20, they'll sell them for $3 to be better able to compete with the pirated versions. People will say, hey, you know what, it's much easier, I'd much rather pay $3 for a brand new, you know, pristine copy than to get a counterfeit copy, which may not be, which may not work correctly, or to try to download one from the internet, especially in China and places like that, where the average citizen doesn't have access to fast internet services. Anyway, that kind of practice where you sell it for $3 in China but $20 in the U.S. does not work, at least over the medium to long term, if you are able to import, especially in large commercial quantities, from China to the U.S. What crafty entrepreneurs will do, like Mr. Kurtzang, is buy up large quantities from the streets of China at $3 a pop, ship them to the U.S., say sell them at $10 or $15, and undercut the price in the U.S. That may be happening in the short term, but of course, that studios will react and likely make the decision that it simply doesn't make sense to sell them at $3 in China when it's going to end up severely undercutting their retail price in the U.S. All right, and just to wrap up, so what do I see the consequences of this decision? One, again, unfortunately, I think it may, at least in the short to medium term, result in an increase in piracy. Two, I think it could lead to some additional use of digital rights management or other forms of technical protection measures to try to thwart the unauthorized import of cheap hard goods from abroad. And what do I mean by that? You may be aware that with DVDs and to somewhat of a lesser extent with Blu-ray discs, studios engage in a practice called region coding, which means that when you buy a DVD in one region, it is playable on DVD players or Blu-ray players in that region only. So if you buy a disc in China, it may not work on a player in the U.S. There's actually been a decrease in the use over the last several years in that practice, especially for Blu-ray, but I think this decision may spur the studios to increase the use, again, to make it unpalatable for people to try to import cheap versions from abroad. I will say the maybe the silver lining in this decision is that it'll probably be of decreasing importance to the businesses of our studios over the medium to long term. Obviously, this case only applies to hard goods, meaning physical items like DVDs or Blu-ray discs. It does not apply to theatrical distribution, where the films are licensed. And it also does not apply to digital distribution, where the films, the files that you obtain are either licensed or, in addition, they involve making additional copies, which, of course, is never covered by the first sale doctrine. So as the world moves from physical distribution of discs to fully digital distribution, this case will probably take on a somewhat lesser importance. But in a lot of parts of the world, of course, hard goods, DVDs, and Blu-rays are still the vast majority of sales. And with that, I think I will pass it back to Mark and open up the discussion.
Thank you, Ben. First, I want to give our panelists a chance to interact briefly. Do any of you wish to make a comment, a further comment, or ask a question of your colleagues?
Well, okay. This is Alan Adler. I guess I would ask Kristen, given the way she closed her remarks with the concern ultimately about a concern we share, too, about how intellectual property protection can fit within an increasing regime of global marketplaces and foreign trade. I'm curious as to what she thought of Judge Breyer's observations, which seemed to indicate that he didn't really acknowledge the idea of territorial rights and the divisibility of copyright.
I'm not sure what I make of it. I don't know that he was being honest, to be fair. I think that there are definitely territorial rights there have been territorial rights in all the different areas of intellectual property for a very long time. So by not acknowledging that they exist, as well as the divisibility, I think was kind of a not a good move on his part. I think that it was disingenuous, there we go, to get at the answer that he wanted to get at. I think he was so concerned with the policy and the parade of horribles that he just overlooked the reality of that, which isn't really a satisfactory answer, but that's kind of what I made of his kind of gloss on the subject.
As moderator, I'd like to ask a question of all the panelists. We critiqued the decision and reacted to it. Let's take a step back and I want to ask you if Congress were to choose to intervene and reestablish an importation right, would that be a good thing? In other words, I want to give everyone, those who would like to, a chance to comment on the policy. Is this the right policy? Should it continue? I think it was implicit in some of your remarks, but you know, is this a policy we should encourage, and why, or why not? Alan, I think maybe I'll give you honor of first place because you've had a direct interest in this.
Well, you know, I would say that one thing that's interesting about the way the court decided the case was, you know, we had a series of opinions, a majority opinion that six justices joined. You had a concurrence that was written by two of the justices who had joined the majority, but seemed to be notably uncomfortable with the rationale of the way in which that the ultimate result was reached. And then, curiously, you had a dissent that included perhaps the most liberal and the most conservative justices of the court, agreeing that ultimately the majority opinion had really made a hash of what copyright law had stood for in terms of some basic principles about extraterritoriality, about exhaustion for many, many years. I think Justice Kagan's concurrence, which was joined by Justice Alito, was very interesting in that she said, you know, it really wasn't necessary to reach this result, and this result probably would not have been the one we would have reached based on our understanding of what Congress intended in the statute, but we were kind of forced to go there because of the Supreme Court's prior decision in the Quality King case. And what she was referring to was the fact that once the Quality King case had construed the first sale doctrine's application to the importation prohibition provisions, it sort of made it difficult to go back down that road and change the result. However, Congress could do that because, as she points out, what Congress seemed to have intended with the first sale doctrine was that the first sale doctrine dealt with questions of particular types of conduct, when a copy of a work had been sold or disposed of, but not when it had been imported. And to the extent that Congress could choose to distinguish the act of importation as being very different from the act of selling or otherwise disposing of an individual copy of a copyrighted work, it opens the door for Congress to essentially say, we meant what we said about the need for the copyright owner to be able to address unauthorized importation of works into the United States, and we don't think that the ability of the copyright owner to do that has to necessarily conflict with the first sale doctrine. So there is a way, perhaps, at least Justice Kagan and Justice Alito believe, for Congress to reconsider the issue so that the individual's use of a copy of a copyrighted work for which they obtained ownership from someone else who was the original owner doesn't have to be impacted, and they don't have to be essentially the people who bear the consequences of allowing the copyright owner to deal with the problem of unauthorized importation. If you address the problem that was created by Quality King Ultimately, it would mean that Congress would be directly addressing people who engage in unauthorized imports rather than the people who subsequently purchase those copies.
Thanks, Alan. I realize now I did pose a question to all of you, but I look at the clock ticking down, and in fairness to our listeners, I want to give people a chance to ask questions if they would like, so I'll need to jump to that now. Dean, can you do what you can you make the usual announcement you do at this time?
So once again, to indicate you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting, let me make a quick programming announcement about the rest of our week and our telephone calls. Tomorrow, April 2nd at 11 a.m., that's an early start time. This is 11 a.m. Eastern time. We're going to host a telephone conference call focusing on the prosecution of financial firms. That will be tomorrow at 11 a.m. at the same number. Then on Thursday, April 4th at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, Federal Society founder and board member Stephen Calabresi and Judge Frank Easterbrook will participate in a teleforum conference call looking at Judge Robert H. Bork, his life and legacy. That's Thursday at 2 p.m. Again, if you have a question, our phone lines are open. You need to push the star button and then the pound button to indicate you have a question. At this point, Mark, we've got a shy audience. We don't have any questions indicated. So,
well, then why don't we continue? I'll hand it back over to our panelists either to address the should question, what should the policy be going forward, what is good about an importation right, or to bring up anything else you would like. Panelists? So I thought, well, I can make you talk. I thought I'd ask Ben. Ben, your comments were definitely forward-looking to the future, but I think there is some real challenges for movie companies abroad. There are markets that they seem to have had to essentially give up because of rampant piracy and inability to enforce. How will this decision affect your ability to compete in those developing markets, the poorer markets?
Well, I think at least in the short term, it's going to be harmful. I went into a bit of detail about the situation in a place like China where, one means of combating piracy has been to sell at low cost, what are essentially the same items as are sold here in the U.S. at a higher cost. This decision is going to make it much harder to engage in those sort of practices. It simply doesn't work if you have people who are going to arbitrage the price differences between, sales in a lesser developed country and those here. I don't want to be all doom and gloom, though. I mean, companies adapt. People come up with both business and technical and marketing means to adapt to changes in the law and changes in marketplaces. So I don't mean to imply that this is going to be the end of the world. But as other panelists have spoken to, there are real benefits from market segmentation. I don't hold myself out as an economist, but I know that when you talk to them, they will talk about price discrimination actually being a good and efficient thing to have sellers be able to maximize their profits in the as to the different consumers to whom they sell, and that of course redounds to the benefit of the seller, but over the long term to the consumer as well, because companies like ours are better able to compete, better able to produce more and more movies. And the same applies, across the copyright industries to music, books, software, et cetera.
Yeah, and this is Alan Adler. I would even add that, with respect to the issue of textbooks, which was the kind of copyrighted work that was at issue in the Kurtzang case, there are, in addition to the benefits that the copyright owners receive, there are also benefits that we receive from international trade that have long been understood by the U.S. government, which is one of the reasons why the U.S. government for generations has done what it can to help bolster and support the ability of U.S. manufacturers and distributors to deal in international markets. In the case of textbooks, for example, the fact that these are widely sought and desired for use by students in other countries provides a tremendous amount of goodwill, the opportunity for foreign cultures to learn more and understand better the United States, both in terms of its popular culture, its history, its political system. There's a great value to having U.S. products be widely available in foreign markets that goes beyond the economic and financial benefits to those who are the producers and distributors. And I think that the U.S. government, cognizant of those benefits, should be very careful to ensure that this highly technical reading that the Supreme Court majority has given to copyright law doesn't cost us those benefits.
Thanks, Alan. Dean, has anyone appeared on the Q&A queue?
We don't have any questions at this point. Our lines are open.
Okay.
If you have a question to the audience, push star and then pound on your telephone. Star and then the pound button on your telephone.
Well, at this point, we're coming up to the top of the hour, so I thought I'd just give each participant perhaps a chance to have a one-minute final summation if they would like. Any final comments? Chris Newman, we haven't heard from you. Any final comments from you?
You haven't heard? Well, you know, I was really interested in the comment that Ben was making about, you know, the distinction between the digital divide. And how I think, you know, you often hear this trope, there's no digital first sale doctrine. And of course, as he pointed out correctly, that's not quite true. What all that means is that to the extent that you are forced to reproduce in order to transfer something, first sale doctrine doesn't cover that. But obviously CDs involve digital copies and, you know, DVDs and all of that does. So, but the reason this is interesting to me is that, you know, as the main reason why it's difficult, I think, to take advantage of the area of the law that I was talking about and actually prevent people from getting ownership of copies is that you have to transact with them in a much more elaborate transaction rather than just selling through distributors on a newsstand, selling in retail outlets. You have to go to some more elaborate provisions of trying to make, you know, binding agreements such that the other side can signify their understanding and their consent and realize that what they're getting is only a license. Now, the reason you can do that easily with software and relatively easily, probably to the extent that you're doing digital streaming performances or things like that, is that it's all done via computer, and you can set it up so that when the end user gets to the point where they actually want to consume the media, they can be required to click through something signifying that they agree to those terms. And so that is, I think, you know, the more than the nature of the actual distribution per se, I think it's the ability to transact digitally, which is what makes the distinction between, say, Werner v. Autodesk on the one hand and UMG on the other. And so, as Ben was pointing out, I think the biggest divide is going to be between parts of the world where that is not yet the normal way of doing business and parts of the world where increasingly the only physical objects that anybody needs to own ownership of are the devices that they use to access content as opposed to individual copies of content. I don't have a crystal ball to know how that's going to play out, but I think that is where the action is going to be going forward.
Thanks, Chris. Final thought from others. Okay. Well, I wanted to thank everybody for participating and what was a very interesting teleforum. This will be edited and recorded into a podcast and made available. And so I'd like to thank all of you for participating on behalf of the Federalist Society as well as George Mason Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property. Dean, is there any final word to be said here?
I'll just add the thanks of the Federalist Society to all our speakers and to Mark Schultz, Mark, for moderating and for organizing this call today. To our audience, I invite you to join us for our teleforum conference call tomorrow at the early start time of 11 a.m. Eastern Time when we'll be discussing prosecuting financial firms. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.